We are here, you are in section 132. The title is Great Movies That Have Expanded My Religious World. Just so you can leave now if you're not supposed to be here. Please turn off your cell phones or any kind of noisemaker. Don't put them on vibrate because we don't want to hear giggling during the middle of the presentations. We have some august panelists today. Let me read you some of their biographical information. Bill Hansen is en route. Bill spent his years growing up in the LA area, moving to Logan, Utah for his last year of high school, where he traded bell bottoms and saddle shoes for Levi's and cowboy boots. Living among young people in the Cache Valley area, who cleaned calf pens, hauled acres of hay, and milked cows after school, balanced by his 1960s California upbringing. His mother's side of the family was involved in Mormonism from its early Nauvoo days, exercising faith enough to preserve family members through polygamy, the trek west, and related colonizations of several areas in Utah. His father taught physics at Utah State, worked in Los Alamos, in the Los Alamos labs in New Mexico, and was selected by Pons and Fleischmann to independently evaluate their work in a flurry in the flurry of excitement surrounding cold fusion in the 1980s, and is producing a current work on the physics of gravity. In short, Brother Hansen's ancestors exemplify both faith and reason. Albert Peck is with us today. Albert is, of course, former editor of Sunstone. He's recently returned to the United States after a successful ascent of K2 and a rapid descent on the lid of a trash can. Anyone who does not submit biographical information gets what he deserves. I was going to say something about his parole, but Becky Linford, a longtime Sunstoner. Sunstoners. I always get that impression, dude. Who, along with her husband Kirk, has organized several regional symposiums in both Chicago and Washington, D.C., where she is famous for her comedy sketches that include lessons in LDS history told through Barbie and Ken dolls. I didn't make that up. Okay. She has a PhD in history from Georgetown University. In May of 2004. She is an assistant professor of history at Marymount University in 2005. Recently moved back to Northern Virginia from Cockeysville, Maryland, where she was expelled for being too cocky, and she is now trying to find a job that pays more than teaching. Okay. D. Michael Quinn. Michael, let's see here. We've got, he is a PhD, an independent scholar, author in early Mormonism, and author of the Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview, served an appointment as the Beinecke Senior Fellow and postdoctoral associate. He is a postdoctoral associate in history at Yale University. Lives in Ranch. Oh, no, no. This was typed in by someone who. English is a third or fourth language. Independent scholar living in Southern California. Just recently, I read that. It's repeating itself. Mike wrote a ton of books. And we'll start off with Eugene, and then we'll go in order of how I introduce people. These things make me very nervous. I'm sorry, I skipped Mark England, who is an artist, a gelato maker, a casket maker, and a rock roller. He was recently the recipient of the 2006 Utah Fellowship Award.
Welcome. It's good to be here. In the Star Trek The Next Generation episode called Darmok, Captain Picard is alone on a planet with Dathon, the captain of a Temerian ship. Although the universal translator is working just fine, they still cannot understand or communicate with each other. Captain Dathon keeps saying things like, Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra, and Chakra when the worlds fell, or Kalamash at Baja. Eventually, Captain Picard gleans that Dathon's way of speaking reflects his brain's way of thinking, which is entirely metaphorical. Each phrase is an allusion to events in Temerian history and mythology, and it is packed with meaning. But even with that insight, Picard has no way to decode Darmok's metaphors. It's like if I met an alien who could speak English, and he could perfectly understand me well, and I said to him, but he hadn't read any of our literature, and I said to him, Juliet at her balcony. You know, for us, we know exactly what I'm talking about, romance, passion, longing, you know, infatuation. Or if I said, Washington at Valley Forge. He'd understand the words, but none of the context. Same with Picard. He just couldn't understand the phrases of Dathon, the Temerian. Well, much of my emotional thinking is similarly episodic and metaphorical. Instead of communicating to myself in abstract words, I often simply and quickly think of movie episodes as metaphors for the situation I find myself in. Such as Thomas More with Cardinal Woolsey, or Luke Skywalker and Yoda in the swamp, or Ma Jode with her St. Louis World's Fair souvenir. Such episodes, and I have many, are emotional touchstones that, when recalled, immediately open my heart and my mind to a story and a life philosophy that I prize. A few years ago, I was in the uncomfortable position of consoling a friend who had just broken up with her boyfriend and who was frustratingly between jobs. Between violent sobs, she lamented that her life was worthless, that she was unemployable, and worse, that she was unlovable. Her situation was not that different from George Bailey's in It's a Wonderful Life, who similarly felt that he was a failure and who contemplated and even attempted suicide, but who eventually realized that his life was rich because he had lots of friends. So I have grabbed at that movie as an emotional life raft so many times that many scenes of it speak to me in a Temerian way, and they invariably bring me solace, inspiration, and even courage. Like George Bailey choosing the building and loan over college, or George Bailey at the bridge, or George Bailey and the bell tinkling on the Christmas tree. I was sure that recalling these scenes would help my friend too. And unlike Captains Picard and Dathon, she and I had the same metaphorical vocabulary. She knew the scenes I'd be talking about. Or so I thought. After patiently indulging me in applying the movie to her life, it was clear that the movie didn't have the same near-canonical status that it did for me. She started crying again. And through her tears, she dismissively said, Oh, Albert, that's just a fairy tale. It's not real life. Just a story, not real life. Never did any put down wound the heart of a man than this did. Than this did at this time to mine. It seemed to enter with great force into every feeling of my heart. I reflected on it again and again, recalling an article about fiction that I read, I think, in the Atlantic magazine, that contrasted how people today approach fiction differently than they did in the 19th century. According to this article, people today read fiction merely for entertainment, for a good fun read, a fast ride, not because they literally believe that it reveals truth, which they can glean from reading it. Whereas a century ago, people felt that fiction, that classic stories, showed life's truths, and they read the fiction in order to discover them. Whether or not that then versus now distinction is really accurate, and it probably isn't, I actually read stories and watch movies to glean truths from them. I also see them for entertainment. Shakespeare's Hamlet is as revelatory to me about living life and as applicable as, say, a biography of Eleanor Roosevelt is, who I dearly love, or the film Gandhi, which is a great film. Even movie titles bring alive whole sermons for me in that Temerian fashion. Oh, I suppose I'll hold that up when I talked about It's a Wonderful Life. Move along here. Whenever I hear On Golden Pond, I'm called to see and love the person see the person behind and beyond the anger and the rage that they have. That happens in that movie. When I see Harold and Maude, I am called to live life to the fullest, now. When I think of Saving Private Ryan, I think of Tom Hanks' dying words to Private Ryan, earn this. And I sense how my life and its liberties are dearly bought and how I'm connected to people I never knew. The Truman Show recalls the existential truth that we accept the reality that's presented to us. Long Day's Journey Into Night cautions me about the destructive and determining family stories that we all repeatedly tell and which trap us, and how there are alternate liberating stories that we could tell if we chose. I could create a large anthology of hundreds of scenes and lines and lessons from movies that articulate and animate my moral, spiritual, emotional, and social lives, and which I replay over and over in my own mind and heart. And I also play them on large and small screens. Still, for every movie I vividly recall, for every movie that has made it into my personal canon, and these are all, you know, movie scriptures, there's a bushel of ones that I've enjoyed thoroughly and blithely and quickly forget. For humans are not really all that different from the Temerians in that Star Trek episode. We live by stories. We consume them daily, hourly. We crave them. We converse. We tell tales. When we dream, we craft, when we converse, we tell tales. When we dream, we craft tales. We hunger for them. Stories are the primary vessels that carry our truths. When making a point, it's often difficult not to explain the journey we took in arriving to that point. For us, the point is often irrelevant without its contextual story. We can't think without stories. Our abstract thinking is supplemental. It's there to help us understand and give meaning to our stories. Man's basic search for meaning is in and by and through stories. A good example of this is Sunstone's annual Pillars of My Faith session. When Peggy Fletcher created that session 25 or so years ago, she, being an intellectual and a theology student, wanted people to get up and list their pillars. Actually, here's like almost like a creed. Here's one, here's another pillar, here's another pillar. It listing and explicating the core doctrines that were most important to them. The doctrinal pillars that held up one's faith. And she was initially saddened and then resigned to the fact that almost invariably, when the person gets up to give their pillars of my faith, it's a faith journey. It's their story. You know, I believe this, and then I changed my mind and believe this, and then this happened, and now I stand here, but who knows for how long. You know. Years later, when I was at Sunstone, and we asked Peggy to do the Pillars of My Faith session, and like almost everyone else, she got up and told her story. We're biologically and socially wired to hear and share stories. Here are four movie tales, briefly, that speak to me and maybe have even changed me. The first is Local Hero. A Texas oil billionaire, Burt Lancaster, sends Peter Reichert to a remote Scottish village to secure property rights. He wants to buy the entire village so they can put an oil refinery there. Mac is a corporate man who communicates through faxes and telephones. It's a great scene where he's talking to where he's just got his assignment to go to Scotland, and he's talking on the phone to someone saying, I've got to go, will you water my plants or whatever, and the guy's in the next room and they're talking through a glass wall. That's how the movie visually shows you what he is. He's disconnected from people. He's atomistic. In the Scottish village, when he gets there, he discovers the importance of relationships, of wealth and community, and the value of things that have no monetary worth. He's literally born again while watching the Northern Lights. It's a wonderful spiritual movie. Next is this 11-part BBC PBS miniseries of Evelyn Waugh's Brideshead Revisited. It's about the patient hand of God in the lives of wandering prodigals. It's a pearl crafted around a grain of a G.K. Chesterton quote from one of his Father Brown mysteries. The quote is, did you catch the thief, Father Brown? Yes, I caught him with an unseen hook and an invisible line, which is long enough to let him wander to the ends of the world and still to bring him back with the twitch of a thread. The wandering and twitching are excellently acted and lushly filmed in this wonderful series. It's only 11 hours, and if anyone wants to borrow this, give it to you. Next is Jesus of Montreal. An actor is hired or called to put on the annual Passion Play at the Cathedral in Montreal. Like Jesus calling the apostles, he recruits his cast from a diverse group of people. The play they put on is controversial, and the established religion tries to stamp it out. The analogy to early Christianity is exquisite. It is a delightful, thoughtful, moving picture, a gem of a film. Finally, there's Ordinary People, which someone borrowed my CD of that, my DVD of that. This well-acted family drama starring Mary Tyler Moore, Donald Sutherland, Timothy Hutton, and Judd Hirsch is about learning to forgive, to accept others for the gifts they have, and not the ones you wish they had. It instructs by showing how the son is brittle and unbending like his mother, and how he learns to be forgiving and flexible like his father. During an intense session with his therapist, Timothy Hutton learns to give himself and his mother some slack. And there's one line in it that I really like that just turned my world upside down when I heard it. He just figures out, he makes a slip of speech where he says, if you think I'm going to forgive, she's going to forgive me. And then he said, the psychiatrist says, what? I think I just figured something out. What? Who it is who can't forgive who? Well, that's a real problem. A real problem is a real solution. I've heard that all before. Doesn't make it any less true. I'm so tired. Yeah, well, that's a hell of a secret you've been keeping on yourself. So what do I do now? Recognize her limitation. You mean, like my mother can't love me? Oh no, kiddo. Like she can't love you enough. Like, don't blame her for not loving you more than she's able. And then it goes on. But that movie, when I saw that scene, it helped me deal with my own sense of imperfection, learning to forgive myself, and to not expect the unexpectable, things you shouldn't expect from other people. And it made a big difference in my life. So those are my movies, and I'm right within time. Thank you very much.
Albert has good taste in movies. It looks like everyone's going to fall in the same way, because I'm seeing some of these other ones too. I have a dream that one day I would be the Provo Temple president, and that instead of showing one of the two temple films in the six endowments rooms, I would show my six favorite movies. Now, this may sound rather irreverent, but I've given this a lot of thought. I take the temple endowments seriously. As a visual artist, I take all forms of visual information seriously. Most of the information we absorb today comes through our eyes. It affects our understanding in ways we may not know ourselves. Visual images stay with us and form our opinions of the world. This is especially true with film. That is why I go to live sessions of the endowment instead of the filmed versions. The endowment is meant to be understood symbolically. It understands that it is an abstract event. I feel the same about films in general. All great film, all great art for that matter, respects its medium and always reminds us of its limitations and abstract nature. A painting or film is just a lie or cheap imitation of life. But for some reason, sometimes those cheap imitations can help us see what we have become desensitized to or forgotten in incredibly transcendent ways. The Temple Endowment is designed to remind us of what we have forgotten and what our purpose is in life. I would like to talk about the six films that I believe respect the highest demands of filmmaking and or appeal to me on a very personal, spiritual level that would be appropriate to what the goals of the temple are. Some of these films introduced completely new ways of seeing the world. Others illustrated what I already understood and believed about the gospel. They represent my personal journey of trying to understand what my religion teaches me about why I'm here and who I am. So, first I need to define the roles of the temple as an extension of the church or my religion. Religion must do two things in order to fulfill its proper role. One, provide us with the structure for service. Two, give us enough information about what life is for that motivates us to rise to our potential as children of God. It must give us greater perspective on our lives and where we are, where we have been, and where we are going. Finally, what we should do to get there. Because we too often forget this, we go to the temple to remind ourselves of what we should be doing with our lives. That is what the endowment is all about. It shows us the big picture. The films I have chosen either showed me a new way of seeing the world that meshed with my understanding of the gospel, or illustrated what I hoped for or believed. They ask questions about who we are and what we should be doing here. They showed me a bigger picture. None of them are literal or didactic, just extremely personal, vulnerable testimonies in film. I apologize that mine are mostly very serious and not for the faint of heart, but I hope this will not stop you from seeking them out. When I was 9 years old, my dad took me to see 2001, A Space Odyssey. I didn't understand it, and only a little better after my dad tried to explain it to me on the way home. What I did understand is that he took it seriously, so I did too. After reading a lot of science fiction and seeing the film six more times, which was pretty difficult in the 70s, I mean, you didn't have VHS or anything, it became a personal expression of my own love of the unique doctrine Joseph Smith taught about our connections to God as his children, and that is summed up in the phrase, as we are, God once was, as God is, we may become. This is the single most radical and powerful expression of humanistic Mormon doctrine there is, that 2001 sums up in a marvelously abstract way. Granted, if taken literally, I doubt Stanley Kubrick was trying to say the same, but he was smart enough to illustrate this in an abstract way which allows for a wide possibility of meanings. In 1982, I went to see the screening of My Dinner with Andre at the Blue Mouse. It is nothing more than a dinner conversation between two men who have not seen each other for a long time. Wally is a depressed man who is overwhelmed with life and basically just surviving. Andre is a rather strange, charismatic man who is completely involved with life. This was the first film that explored what was becoming a nagging obsession with me in my life. Who am I? What am I doing here? And what with this life I have? The big questions that everyone must ask. By the end of the dinner conversation, Wally has gone through a transformation that is quite magical. The film invites us to do the same. I had already developed an arrogant, superior attitude about who I was, my tastes, my skills as an artist, and my ability to understand religious and political issues. And yet, like Wally, I was depressed, angry, and I had this nagging doubt that something was not working, and maybe I was wrong. Self-deluded, like the people I judged and looked down on because they were so self-deluded and desensitized. So I kept looking at art in the hope that it would indirectly give me knowledge of what I refused to experience or see myself. In other words, I used art as a substitute for genuine living. In 1983, my father suggested I see a Russian film at International Cinema at BYU called The Stalker. I was dubious, but went anyway, thankfully. This film, along with many other films at BYU, thanks to Don Marshall, introduced me to the work of Andrei Tarkovsky, a Russian filmmaker who died of lung cancer soon after making his seventh film in 1986. Almost all of his films deal with the questions of who we really are and what are the implications of what we do with our lives, especially the films Solaris and his last film, The Sacrifice. We all have a conscious sense of who we are, but that often has nothing to do with who we really are. The part of ourselves that we deny, refuse to admit, repress, suppress, react to, and that reflects our true inner desires. Who are we stripped of our comfortable lies and images of ourselves? When Abraham went out into the desert, he was trying to find out who he was, independent of the culture his father had taught him. He wanted something more. When Moses went into the mountains, he was trying to find his identity as a Jew free of Egyptian influence. When Joseph went into the forest, he was seeking answers to what he should be doing with his life in ways he did not anticipate. I too fancied the idea that I was asking the big questions, but I was only going to movies, museums, talking big, and reading books. Those are just substitutes for the direct confrontation with answers that Joseph, Moses, Abraham, and many others have done. Joseph didn't just read about God or go to an inspiring movie about God. He talked to God. In the movie Stalker, there is a forbidden zone that has been walled off from society because there are strange supernatural things that happen in it. It is believed that there is a room in a building in the zone that if you enter, your innermost desire will be realized. A man called a stalker illegally takes people on this dangerous journey into the zone, to this room. The movie is about this journey he takes with two other men and the conversation they have. The conversation covers everything about God, why we exist, what are our true desires, do we even know or want to know what they are, and what do we do with such a power or gift or curse. Aside from being thrilled with the painfully visually beautiful aspects of the film, I was challenged by the big question the film had articulated. Who am I, stripped of my self-delusions? Of course, the film could not answer this question. No religion could, no art could, no person could. Even if they could, which many people tried to at times, I would not listen because it was not convenient. It took me a while to realize that movies and art could not give me that answer. They could give me the question. It would only come through revelation, which took about another 20 years to get. In October of 2001, I also got that answer that I had been seeking. It was not what I expected or wanted, and yet it was the greatest gift I had ever received after my children. Thankfully, the movie Stalker helped me visualize and seek out what I needed to know and prepare myself to receive it. Back to 1994. That year I saw Wings of Desire. This film is gloriously beautiful, mysterious, romantic, and challenging, and should not be confused with the Hollywood version of City of Angels. It follows the lives of angels who observe humans, trying to understand them and ultimately want to be human. I think it comes very close to what I imagine the spirit world to be, which is all around us. It poses the basic questions of why we even came to Earth, to know, to experience, to learn, to grow, to gain a body. It also has one of the most beautiful film sequences in the history of film. It happens when the two angels are at the Berlin Wall debating whether to become human. This film gets to the heart of the implications of coming to Earth, experiencing joy and pain, giving up one state in order to gain a new level of understanding. If you see this film, either watch it alone or make sure it is with someone who won't say stupid, distracting comments. That is true of all of these films. Now let me digress a moment. all the films I have mentioned require a lot of concentration and patience. They are exhausting. Make sure you are watching them without interruption, with a lot of sleep, I mean, with a lot of rest beforehand. I mean, you're gonna fall asleep if you don't have your full attention. You know, don't watch them like, you know, starting at 9 o'clock at night. You're gonna fall asleep. They are exhausting in many scenes, with many scenes with long dialogues or long sequences. I mean, you know, a film sequence without a break. I mean, the camera will just pan slowly across. Some of them will, Tarkovsky has, I think, one of the longest uninterrupted pans in history. It's like 6 minutes. The camera just keeps running for like 6 minutes in a number of his films. They are mind-bending stories that should change your life. If they don't, then you haven't seen it enough times, or you aren't getting it yet. A few years later, I saw Joe versus the Volcano. On the surface, thank you, Albert. On the surface, this is a silly movie that people don't take very seriously. And yet, there are a number of scenes that unexpectedly change gears into very poignant, profound levels of observation about what it means to give up one's old life, take on a new way of being, understand and acknowledge the gift and grace of life, and even express this through a prayer by the main character, Tom Hanks. It is difficult for people to figure this movie out because it also has some truly wacky moments as well. My last film is It's a Wonderful Life. This film needs no explanation. When one of the films breaks down, then I would substitute Home for the Holidays and Pieces of April. If religion is supposed to help us with the big questions of life, who we are, where did we come from, why are we here, where are we going, then these are the movies that come closest to our uniquely Mormon point of view. This doesn't surprise me that they are all made by non-Mormons. These doctrines are universally humanistic, which is what was most powerful about what Joseph Smith taught. I would be surprised if a Mormon ever made a film like any one of these. It would be great if they did. I think we're just too close to the story and the doctrine, and we're too self-conscious to make it without being caught up with how would be accepted, does it get it right, does it get the doctrine right, and everything else. I'm just grateful that some people have the courage and clarity of mind to see and express these questions in such powerful ways.
My name is Bill Hansen. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today and discuss two films that have influenced me spiritually. One is called Babette's Feast. How many have seen this movie? I think on most people's lists, if you had to list top 10 movies of your life, Babette's Feast usually shows up on that list somewhere. And another movie that was just commented on, Pieces of April. How many have had the opportunity to see Pieces of April? I believe this started off as a Sundance Film Festival film and then was released publicly. It's very interesting. Both of these movies hit me in the heart in the following way. Both of these movies deal with fractured communities. In Babette's Feast, you have Babette, the exile, who's dealing with a fractured community, a Lutheran community, a very austere community in Denmark, or if you're reading the book, it's a little island in Norway, that has come at odds. The members of this community, despite their attempt at a Zion society, have come at odds with each other over petty grievances. Certainly no Zion here. And then, in the movie Pieces of April, April, a pop culture icon, is estranged from her family because of various difficulties. In both cases, in both movies, the movie focuses on the reunification of these groups or these societies through a meal, through eating together. There was a beautiful article written in the spring 1993 Dialogue by John Crusoe, that comments on this. The article is entitled Jesus as a Peasant. And he says the following thing, if you'll allow me just to read this one paragraph. In all societies, both simple and complex, eating is the primary way of initiating and maintaining human relationships. Once the anthropologist finds out where, when, and with whom food is eaten, just about everything else can be inferred about the relations among the society's members. To know what, where, how, when, and with whom people eat is to know the character of the society. And so you find him discussing what's called the commensal relationship. Commensal means eating together. And in the New Testament in particular, you read story after story about Jesus eating with publicans and sinners, the marriage feast, who comes, who doesn't come. And all of the stories about eating together. The way these things hit my life is in a couple of ways. When I returned to college after serving a mission and going through the usual disorientation, through a miracle, I obtained a mentor by the name of Robert Bennion, who was a psychologist and an instructor, a professor. He became a lifelong friend of mine through the grace of God, basically. And as I associated with him in a number of different settings, something became very apparent. Besides the fact that he was an extremely balanced person, whenever I would go to him for advice or for a discussion, he would invite me into his unusual house, which was probably a third atrium. That may be a little exaggerated. He had living plants growing in his home, guava trees, banana trees, orange trees, other trees. And as you would go into his home, he would, before he would talk to you at all, his first words were, "Have something to eat." And with an orange or a guava or whatever else was being offered, I would sit and discuss the topic at hand. And although I didn't understand it at the time, the commensal relationship that existed as through several years he mentored me was truly remarkable. And it reminds me of the fact that in eating together and in associating together, that is where you can say the rubber hits the road. The spiritual meets the temporal at the table. And to understand that ended up being kind of an intuitive motivator throughout my life. When I graduated from law school, our family moved down to Payson, a small community just south of Spanish Fork, Payson, Utah, I should say, not Payson, Arizona. The reason we moved to Payson was because it was a small community, and that was where we could feel spiritually the rubber hit the road in terms of affecting people's lives and being affected by them. These movies demonstrated and put a voice to a feeling that I had been acting on intuitively. Then another area that it gave voice to was a spiritual experience that happened while I was serving a mission in Brazil. I was in what was known at the time as the Brazil North Mission. It was 1972, and There had been no revelation on the priesthood, so it was an unusual place to be since more than 4/5 of the population was black. The missionaries had kind of an unusual attitude, but it was slim pickings in the Brazil North Mission until another mentor of mine arrived on the scene, a new president by the name of George Oakes. And after examining the situation, he called us together and he said, "Brethren, we need to do something different. If you can find it in the scriptures, you can do it. And what I want you to do is go without purse or script into the mission field, and I want you to teach in every house that you go in, black or white, and I want you to call the family together, pray with them, black or white, ask if they have any sick, heal their sick, black or white." And so we began doing that, and we became very successful at it, to the extent that you would sometimes be in 20 homes a day. And in those homes, what happened was kind of a miracle. As you would bless people, as you participated in that spirituality, and one of the other things that we did was invite them to attend the church of their choice. And as we participated in that process, they invited us to eat with them. And we did eat with them, lunches and dinners, constantly provided. And we were able to be in that situation for an extended period of time, months after months, without any purse or script, so to speak, because of the rubber meeting the road in that particular way. Now, in the movie Babette's Feast, you'll recall that just like the wedding feast, there were those who were supposed to be the elect of God who didn't show up. And in fact, in Babette's Feast, the religious folk make a covenant among themselves that they're not even going to enjoy the dinner. And so they sit silently by while they don't, while an enemy to Babette, remember she had been a refugee from France, a French army officer who happens coincidentally to be there, is the one that is spiritually awakened by the feast. And he reveals that Babette is the famous chef of the Café Anglais in Paris, and of the wonderfully, spiritually enlivening foods that she served, all of which, of course, have metaphors in the movie and have spiritual connections. It turns out that gradually the fragmented community reunites, and the final scenes, of course, show them hand in hand, burying their differences and uniting in dance, a reunited community. To contrast that with Babette, or with April is not a culinary genius. She's a culinary novice. And she is reaching out to her family one last time to try to establish something that has been destroyed over and over and over. She tries something that's out of her comfort zone. And unlike Babette's feast, it turns out in many ways to be a bizarre fare. For example, she has to borrow an oven to get the meal prepared to cook a turkey. In return for borrowing the oven, a neighbor yanks a turkey leg off, and so her turkey looks like only part of a turkey by the time she serves it. Despite the bizarre fare, the spirit is the same. She provides a meal, she gets through it, and reunites her family. And I believe that we should all pay more attention to what Christ did commensally and contemplate that particular way of uniting with our communities, in our families, in our communities, and to, if you're interested, rewatch those movies or watch them with that commensal relationship in mind.
I'm the one female, in case you were wondering, here today. And I did not make this a matter of fasting and or prayer. I just sat down and thought about some of my favorite movies of all time and what made them my favorite movies of all time. I'm interested in what Albert described when he talked about ordinary people. The relationship between that boy and his mother is something I can relate to very closely. And my mother just passed away 2 months ago. And one of the reasons I'm here is to sort of work through, sort through 50 years of crap with my sister and a couple of other of my siblings. And that really struck me that I kind of learned to work out things after I saw that movie. So I know it's true. Now, 2001, I'm in that group that just didn't get it. I just thought it was a bunch of damn monkeys beating bones on stuff. And I hate monkeys. Let's see. I love The Odyssey, starring Armand Desante, because he's really hot. And also the theme of The Odyssey, of course, the Iliad, and it shows very flawed human beings doing spectacular things. And it shows very flawed human beings in their relationship to the gods. And I love that. And we'll get a little bit, get more for that a little bit later. Some of these movies, Fitzcarraldo, has anybody seen that movie? It has the most amazing scene in it of all movies, in my opinion. These Native Americans dragging a steamboat over a mountain, and they actually had to do that in, you know, to make the movie. And it's just amazing to see. It didn't make my religious life any different, but it was really good. let's see. Oh, there's a documentary made by a woman here in Utah about the Smith family. PBS, it was on PBS. This is about 5 years ago, I believe, 4 or 5 years ago. This had a huge impact on me. It was about a family in the valley here. The dad was my age. He served a mission in Italy, in the same mission that I was in just after he was there. And he was an airplane pilot and a twin, and he contracted AIDS. He was gay, and this gal was given unlimited access into the Smith family, into their home, and watched as this woman, especially, I don't remember her name, but the wife, she also contracted AIDS from him. And she stayed with him through thick and thin, through treatments, through sending their oldest son on a mission, and kept him at home where he was happiest and where she could take care of him. And she's a nurse. And I thought about that documentary for days. I was thinking about the Christ-like character of that woman that forgave her husband even though he had made her ill and betrayed their relationship and stayed with him forever. I felt very humbled when I watch that. Let's see. I love the Field of Dreams, and I love the producers because it has the very best musical production number of all time, Springtime for Hitler. And if you, I haven't seen the new version of it, but it's awesome. I prefer the Zero Mostel Gene Wilder version, the original. Finally, my two most important movies. The first one is Defending Your Life, an Albert Brooks movie. Yeah. I love that on so many levels, but especially because it's Albert Brooks. He's my neurotic hero. He is every man to me because he's neurotic and fearful and anxious. He's always anxious and and that's me. So I loved watching him learn what he had not learned during his life, and that was how to meet your fears, how to overcome your fear, how to live life to the fullest. And I totally believe that's true for all of us who are very neurotic, like me. Face your fear and live life. This is the only chance we're gonna get. And my last movie is Schindler's List. And this goes right in line with making me think about God, the universe, everything differently. In 1980, I was a member of BYU's a cappella choir, and we went on tour to Poland, among other places, Vienna. We were in some good places, too. But Poland, and part of that tour, we went to Auschwitz. And has anybody been to Auschwitz? Yeah. I don't know if you experienced the same thing, but I felt a change in my entire persona. I felt a change in how I believed, in my mind, in my spirit. I'm not even going to try to describe it, but I remember hearing a lot of the kids, other choir members, saying, "Why did God do that?" You know, very kind of a Mormon thing. And then why did God let that happen? And this is a big question. It's a huge question. This movie and the experience of going to Auschwitz made me question everything. I had been so happy thinking that God was my cosmic servant, and I had been on a mission, so I was mature and pretty much knew everything there was to know, and this threw everything over. And something clicked and changed in my soul, and fortunately I took some time and really tried to process this. And when the movie Schindler's List came out, you know, I was a little skeptical, because how can you take on such a big enterprise? And the movie really is about two things. It is about the Holocaust, but it is mostly about Oskar Schindler. Again, Schindler is a heroic figure, but when we think of heroes, you know, we think of little Tommy Monson going to the widows, or Mother Teresa, or Gandhi, you know, all of these people with ethics and morals that we should live up to. Not Schindler. Schindler was a womanizer. He was an alcoholic. He was amoral. He was a good con man, and he was out for a buck. My kind of guy. And he was able to change. He went through a metamorphosis, and I love the movie because it was very subtle. It wasn't in your face, over the top. You really had to watch to see the change that came over Schindler. At the end of the movie, you know, he begins as this guy who's making bargains with the devil, the Nazis, and ends by saving over 1,100 Jews. And today there are 6,000 descendants of Schindler's Jews, as he calls them, and only 4,000 Jews still remaining in Poland. So you can see the effect that one man has on life and on history. And so it was the big picture and then what the individual can do. I love the fact that flawed human beings can rise to do wonderful, miraculous things. Thanks.
I was up until midnight last night preparing the wrong kind of presentation. I was keying videos to the scenes that I was going to play as I introduced them and then commented on them afterwards. And I was working under the assumption that everyone was going to be doing that. And so for me, my text was expendable. What was important were the clips. And so I, even as I was writing text, anticipating, I trimmed down the movies by a third that I was going to show. And then last night, as I was timing my clips, I cut another half of the movies away, and therefore another half of my comments. So I'm not going to show the clips. I apologize to those of you who started to work with me and have struggled with me in trying to prepare these clips, because I was hiding behind the clips and was willing to surrender my text. And all of you, we're talking about inspiration, you all have inspired me to go back to my text, which I was willing to surrender to the medium. So just a moment and I will reshuffle my remarks, and then I will give you the text and verbally describe the scenes. Pop culture filled my childhood. Each week, at least 20 hours of TV, plus a minimum of 3 movies in theaters from age 5 until 18, weekly. Sometimes my soul resonated with certain scenes from a medium whose crass purposes are simply to entertain and make lots of money. But moving moments inspiring to me might be unimpressive to somebody else. Spirituality, like art, is subjective. My first example is a movie I watched on TV at age 8 or 9. The Grapes of Wrath in 1940 portrayed the recent depressions, despair, exploitation, and the indifference, sometimes hostility, of the comfortable toward the disadvantaged. I was spellbound at this scene, which I will now describe, where you have Henry Fonda playing one of the Joads, and he has suffered with them, and for more than one reason is going to be leaving the family. And his mother expresses fear about how am I going to know what's happening to you? They might kill you. Somebody might hurt you. And he talks about this belief that we are all connected spiritually, that all humans are spiritually connected. And so he said, if you see a cop beating up on a man, I'm there. If you see people hungry, I'm there. If you see children hungry and then thrilled with being able to eat, I'm there. And for me, that movie remained a challenge, and it continues to remain a challenge for me as one of the privileged, and I sometimes don't always see myself that way, but I certainly am and have been my whole life, to remember the disadvantaged and to intervene. I grew up in a Los Angeles community that excluded blacks, Asians, and Mexicans from residence. Because I was a crypto Chicano, concealed behind Irish names and living with Anglo grandparents, I felt affinity with The Searchers, a 1956 Western. Comanches massacre a Texas family and raise its surviving child to marry the warrior who killed her parents. She is a concealed Anglo among Indians. And after a decade of searching, her uncle decides to kill her if he finds her, rather than allow his niece to remain one of the ethnic people he hates. Instead, there is another outcome, and the scene is of him bringing her back to a home that will accept her. Like most Americans of the 1950s, he cannot overcome his ethnic hatreds and leaves the home that accepts his Indianized niece. But he makes an exception to his prejudice, out of love, or out of duty, or out of common decency. As a closeted gay Chicano at age 12, that was what I hoped for. Inspiring to me was the scene of divine compassion I saw in the movie Ben-Hur when I was 15. Again, in the clip, you have a chain gang of slaves who are being herded to their eventual destination as galley slaves, which is a death sentence. They're worked to death, or if the ship sinks, they are chained to their rows, and they die with the sinking ship. They march through a village, Nazareth, as it turns out, and Jesus gives a drink of water to the hero who is at the point of absolute surrender to death. He has given up all hope. And the touch of Jesus and the compassion of Jesus, more than the drink of water, it's the scene has resonances with the New Testament in a number of ways, but more than the water, it's the eternal water that Jesus gives that inspires him beyond reality, beyond hope that he could have had to continue on. Now, after the clip I didn't show, Jesus does not spare this man from pain, nor from shackles, nor from almost certain death as a slave. Instead, the divine gives strength to suffering humanity with the comfort of unconditional love. As children, many of us bargain with God when asking for things. I still pray in this selfish way, but also remember the humbling experience of watching this scene from a biblical epic when I was 22. And the scene comes from the John Huston movie, in the Bible in the Beginning. And it's the scene where Abraham bargains with God. Because God has revealed a secret to Abraham, that he has passed through Abraham's holdings and his camp on the way to destroy the cities of the valley. As he's starting to leave, Abraham says, "But truly, if you are a God of justice, if you are the ruler of all, you would not destroy the whole city if there were 50 people." And then he bargains with God, and it goes down. "No, I won't destroy it for 50. And then it goes down and down. And finally, Abraham, as God has already disappeared in this face-to-face view, Abraham says, "One more. I want to make one more, my last comment. What if they're just 10? And then the voice of God says, "If there are 10, I will not destroy the city for the sake of the 10. Well, after showing the clip, which I'm not showing you, my question is, actually two questions. How often in our prayers, in our hopes, in our faith, do we bargain with God for strangers? Do we bargain with God for those whom we regard as our moral inferiors? Nearing graduation from college, I was confident of my life's path, and I shed tears during the 1966 Sound of Music when the Catholic Mother Superior sings "Climb Every Mountain" after she has counseled the young nun to follow her heart and the opportunity God gives to her, even if they lead her away from her obligations to the church. I was even resonating with that on levels I didn't realize at the time. But my generation's stumbling block was the Vietnam War. Most friends avoided the draft, while one missionary associate protested the war and fled to Canada. In 1968, I volunteered for 3 years of service, during which I was stunned to learn, first, that a friend participated in the Phoenix Program's assassinations of South Vietnamese liberals and suspected communists. Second, that a missionary buddy died as an Army Ranger during the illegal invasion of Cambodia by U.S. forces, and third, that National Guard troops killed students who protested this invasion. Thus, I felt shame and sadness in watching this scene from the movie Hair about our government's cannon fodder of war, and I'm still tempted to show it to you. But it's the scene of these soldiers marching into a basically a black hole. It's a C-40 transport plane, but it's like a black hole of war, a black hole of death. And after showing you this scene, which is a musical scene, it's a deeply moving scene for me. It is one that I have never forgotten. In fact, as I was queuing these videos last night, I hadn't seen any of them since I saw them in the movie theaters, and they hit me with the same power. And I wrote these remarks anticipating these scenes, having not seen them since I originally saw them. And so that's the power that they had in my life, in some cases 40 years after the fact. Leaving the military in 1971, I was bitter about the war destroying millions of Vietnamese and hundreds of thousands of Americans. I found spiritual uplift in that year's movie musical, Fiddler on the Roof. There is nothing romantic, it said, about poverty, nor about living with tyranny, nor about being attacked by those who hate you for being different. Yet we should live life as fully as possible. And I was inspired by this scene when mutually suspicious ethnic groups decide to enjoy each other's company. And the scene I was going to show you is the bar scene that is both a singing and a dancing scene of Russian peasants who were tended to be the most anti-Semitic of Russia's population, and Jews who lived on the other side of town, and they intermingle for the first time in this scene that's to live L'Chaim. I conclude with the theme of one's responsibility to others. In the 1980 movie Resurrection, a woman nearly dies and then discovers that her touch can heal the sick and disabled. After running away to escape media attention, church zealots, and hostile unbelievers, she does not abandon her gift. And I insist that you see this movie, so I'm not going to even tell you the final scene that I was going to show, which is truly wonderful. Despite their profit motive, Hollywood movies can be a spiritual force for good, at least in the eye of the beholder. Thank you.
We'd like to thank our panelists for their contributions today. We do have a few minutes for question and answers. If you will, please, if you have a question, come to the mic so that we can get you on the recording, and we will ask that the panelists who wish to respond come up to this mic.
All your choices were excellent, but I was disappointed that nobody mentioned Crash, which I think is the best movie of all time. It's maybe living and working, or in California, working in Oakland, it's more poignant to people out in the, but I'd like you to talk about that. And talk about Dutcher's latest, States of Grace, which some critics have called the Mormon Crash. I thought that was very good too, but not as broad in scope as Crash.
When I saw Crash, it came out early in the year, and in seeing it, I was just drop-jawed, really, during most of it. It was a very difficult movie to see. And my first reaction was, the Academy has a very short memory span, and this movie isn't going to be remembered. And I thought, this is tragic. But it was this very uncomfortable image and look at racism and how deeply it operates through all races, but how deeply it operates in our own race and whatever that race may be, it can involve not only feelings of inferiority but feelings of superiority. It's a gritty, in many ways, a difficult to watch movie, but one everyone should see. When the Academy Award time came, my unexpected favorite was Brokeback Mountain, which as a gay male, I really wanted to win the award. And I was amazed that it had the legs that it did have with the Academy. and that it was even nominated, and that the fact that it might win Best Picture was just unbelievable, that it had that kind of those kind of legs. But when the decision was made for Crash and the camera came on to the cast, and they were just, you know, stunned that they had won Best Movie. And I, even though I was disappointed that Brokeback Mountain did not win, it was a very small, wonderfully done movie, which had messages that resonate obviously with me, but I thought, good for Crash, because it, when I first saw it, I thought, this is going to be the best movie of the year. Too bad no one will remember it at voting time in the Academy.
Yes, I was wondering if any of you had seen Woody Allen's, I think it's Crimes and Misdemeanors, which seemed to me, not that it was inspirational, maybe more amoral, asked very fundamental existential questions. If there's any comments?
I think it's a great movie. And you're right, and it's all, you can only pick a few, and that's the wonderful movie.
An even more devastating version of that is Nashville.
Yeah.
Let me throw one in real fast, too. I realize this is sort of a bit of an issue that hasn't been touched upon. I'd like to see Sunstone programs, a whole forum on the clean flicks controversy, because, you know, all us being artists in our own rights, I think, you know, none of us like to see our art compromised, regardless of, you know, the fact that there might be people out there that might disagree with how we present the art. And I would like to get anybody's feeling on the panel as far as, you know, now I understand they're trying to get the airlines versions, you know, in the same sense that the airlines are showing them, so they can get past this copyright problem and still be able to show the movie. But I feel, you know, there's a lot of things in the movies that sometimes do offend me. And but yet, I feel I shouldn't compromise with the integrity of what the artist is trying to portray. I either like it or I hate it. But anyway, I would like to just get your impressions on that type of, on the Killing Fix situation, maybe in 25 words or less, I don't know.
I believe that the ruling from the court in the Clean Flicks case was a very sophisticated ruling and turned on a number of issues. I personally believe that it was a correct ruling, that based on the First Amendment and due process and equal protection arguments of the Constitution, that the rights of the originator of the movies supersede the rights of other people to limit that or to exclude that. Other people have other avenues, in my opinion, to avoid or limit the types of things that they view without attacking the work product of the originator. That was my opinion about it.
Looks like we're going to get out early for lunch. Thank you very much.